common courtesy. Common courtesy has to be a necessity. A sense of humor doesn't hurt either, I can tell you that. In fact, many times a sense of humor can save the day on your relationship. I know one year around Christmas time, we were at JD's mother's, and she had a real long driveway. And I'm not a good backer-upper, I'll be the first to admit it, but I was backing up that night. And I got off of the beaten path. It had been raining, and I sunk the truck up to the axle on the left-hand side. And J.D. began to scream and curse and call me everything but a human being. But I made a decision that morning that nothing he was going to say or do was going to ruin my day. That God was going to be my God for that day. And I got out of the truck, him screaming and hollering, and I walked around and I looked at it and I said, well, I'll be damned, J.D., it's still in the mud. That didn't help. I said, would you like to call the wrecker and do something that might help? And he laughed. And he said, it didn't help, did it? I said, no. But you know, before, I would have taken all that to heart. But I didn't have to that day because, you see, I'd made a decision and turned it over to God for that day. There's a difference between affecting someone adversely and upsetting someone, aggravating someone. To me, adversely means it's going to leave a lasting negative effect on that person. I'm responsible for my actions, not how my partner perceives it. We do things without expectations. It feels good. If it feels good, you know, back in the 60s they said, if it feels good, do it. Well, that's not autonomous action because that can give you a license to kill. But I found it for me, if it feels good and it doesn't hurt anyone, especially me or my relationship, do it. I've been in that relationship long enough now, I know the things that are going to hurt it for sure. And if I keep away from those things, I can't be too far off. Tradition 5. Each marriage or relationship has but one primary purpose, to serve as an expression of God's love. My high power loves me unconditionally, in spite of my character defects and shortcomings, just because I'm his kid. That's the only reason. And that's my example on how to love others, unconditionally, no matter what they do or don't do. That doesn't mean I have to accept unacceptable behavior, but I don't quit loving someone because their behavior is unacceptable. I have seen mothers do this for years. Their kid's out there doing ratty things. They don't quit loving the kid because he's doing ratty things. They don't enjoy the things he's doing, but they don't quit loving them. And I had to learn how to love like that. God's will takes nothing away. It only enhances. And when God is removed from a relationship, the relationship will die because self-will is a destructive thing, and it will kill. Self-will run riot. The big book calls it a tornado roaring through people's lives. And that's what my self-will did. It's not just the alcoholic that has the ability. If you ever read the big book in terms of your behavior and your thinking versus the alcoholic's drinking, you'll find that we're all the same. So my only, I have one primary purpose. My focus is only on one thing now, to express God's will. Not what I want, but what my higher power wants. I found a great tool in this area is to ask my higher power to let me see others as he sees them. Have you ever asked to see things through God's eyes? Years ago, when I was trying to work out my relationship with my mother, there was a girl that God sent from Missouri to Arkansas just for a year. And I've never seen her since. But Betty helped me tremendously. God used Betty as a tool to help me. And she brought me this tool. She said, ask God to see your mother like he sees her. Now, when I saw my mother, I always saw this mean, vicious, ratty little woman that had the power to absolutely make me quiver in my boots. I always wanted her approval. I needed that. I wanted her to love me. And when I would see her, I would see this mean, rotten, ornery person who was not going to love me. And that day that I finally asked God to do that, when I drove up to my mother's, I didn't see her like that. I saw her as a frightened, lonely, wounded, scarred individual. Someone needing love, not someone with the ability to give love. So it made a big difference, and I had compassion for my mother, and I had never had compassion for her at all. And that began a healing process for us in our relationship. And our relationship was very good for a number of years, best it had ever been. And then, like I say, my mother has gotten hardening of the arteries to the brain, and this year she has been a little worse, and she's gotten fantasy becomes fact to her. And she has imagined hurts and things that happen, and she blames the family. And as such, she has been down on all of us this year and not really wanting to have a relationship with us.
But thank God I had some good times, and I can accept her even as she is today. But the bottom line is, even in expressing love to her today, the way I do this now, is I ask myself, how would a loving daughter treat her mother? How would a loving sister treat a sister? How would a loving wife treat a husband? And so I try to go ahead and take the action, because we learn in here that action, we take action against our thinking. Because my thinking gets sometimes, I don't want to be around her. She's so mean and hateful to me when she's around me. And then I say, but a loving daughter would go and do these things regardless of what a mother would do. And always when I go and do these things, things that I really don't want to do, but a loving daughter would do them, when I leave, I know I've done God's will, and I feel good. It amazes me. And the bottom line to that is, I am free of my mother's approval. I no longer have the need for my mother's approval, because I know I've done the right thing according to what my higher power would have me do. And it freed me. I don't have to, and I can feel real good. And see, that was something, I had a hole in me. That was one of those holes. I always wanted Mama to say, good girl, you did a good job. I love you. I care for you. Well, see, she doesn't have to. She's not going to say those things. And so God filled that hole and said, I love you because you did the right thing. You're okay because you did the right thing. So my primary purpose is to do what God would have me to do, living on a daily basis. My sister, like I say, is not in the program. She's a wonderful person, but she's not in this program. And sometimes I forget when I'm with her, and I'll talk program with her, and she doesn't talk program. She'll say, that's some more of that Al-Anon stuff, isn't it? And I called her the other day, and I said, how are you? She said, well, I would tell you I didn't feel good, but then you'd tell me I was sitting on my pity pot, so I can't tell you that. But I ask myself many times, when my sister seems to make demands of me and what have you that I really don't like, or I don't particularly want what's coming down, what would a loving sister do in this situation? And that's where I go to God. You know, I have to have God's love in me, so I go to God to get from Him what I need so that I can take it back and share it with my sister. And sometimes the loving thing to do is not to allow her to manipulate me, which she has a tendency to do, and I let her. And sometimes it's hard to fight the consequences of those actions, but I have to do. But I am trying to be a loving sister. I'm trying to be a loving wife. And if you will ask yourself before you go into a course of action, is this what a loving wife would do? I think a lot of times you can tell yourself on the front end if it is or isn't. Also in our preamble, it talks about giving comfort and encouragement to the alcoholic. Well, we give comfort and encouragement to our loved ones. That's expressing God's love. That means giving praise, positive strokes, not centering on their negatives, encouraging them through their positives, being honest, giving credit where credit's due. You know, by and large, people do the very best they can on any given day. I don't think anybody in the world starts out one day saying, I think I'm going to be the biggest butthole I can be today. I don't think it. Sometimes we are. But I don't believe that's our goal when we start off in the day. And you know yourself that every bit of the sickness that you've practiced, every bit of the harm you've done to get to where you are today, that was your motivator to get to where you are today. The Big Book talks about our past is our greatest asset. And I would look at that garbage from the past and I would say, how can that be an asset? Because, for me, it gives me tolerance and patience with the people around me, because I know that I can be just like that on any given day if I don't. The bottom line is I have a way to live now where I don't have to do that. It's my choice. Whether I'm in a success or a failure will not be found out by isolated incidents in my life. I was real bad about judging people. Real bad about judging. And you know, when I look back over it, I heard a long time ago, judge not lest you be judged. And I thought that meant that if I judged you, God would get me. That's what I thought when I read that. I don't believe that today. What I think that means to me today is, if I judge you, I will surely judge me. And I will judge me harder than God or anyone else has ever thought about judging me. And when I judge myself that way, it really destroys me. It destroys that part within me. So I try not to judge others. Because, like I say, I know what I'm capable of. I know what I've done in the past. And yet, it's funny, I'll be around somebody who's doing exactly what I used to be doing, and I will look down my morally superior nose at them. And then all of a sudden, I will catch myself up short, and I'll say, that is not expressing. God's love always has the element of forgiveness. God's love has forgiveness. Even God doesn't judge you till everything is in. You know, it doesn't say that we get judged on a daily basis. You know, you think God's got time to sit around and make all those lists we've given him credit for all these years? She did good today. She did rotten there. You know the only person that kept that list? You. You were the only person that kept that list on you. Because a true judge doesn't judge till all the facts are in. And our facts are not going to be in until the end. So I'm not going to worry about that. All I have to worry about is one day at a time doing the best and give other people the right to be doing the very best they can, even if it is a pile. You know? That may be the very best they're capable of, because there's been days and that is the very best I am capable of. No matter how hard. Haven't you had days that no matter what you touch, it just turns to mess? As hard as you try, and the harder you try to correct it, the worse it goes. Wouldn't you hate to think that somebody was judging you by that? That was a major defect with me. When I took my first inventory, being judgmental and critical came out as a primary character defect. On my second inventory, being judgmental and critical came out as a primary character defect. On my third inventory, being judgmental and critical came out to be a prime character defect. And it was pointed out to me that there didn't seem to be any improvement in this area. And what is the problem? I enjoy it. I don't want to give it up. But she pissed me off. I'm going to, when I do that next inventory next year, by God, she's not going to catch me on this. So when I did my next inventory, she said, "You've really improved." And I did it for the wrong reason. I did it to get that. But the bottom line was, I did it. And I saw that it was possible. And so I said, "Hey," and I felt better about me. Because there's no way I can bring you down without feeling bad about me. I wish I could, but I can't. Because I know that when I'm pulling you down, I'm doing wrong. I used to do it, and it was a freebie. But now you have the curse of Al-Anon, and you notice it. I never judged anyone as harshly as I did myself. I beat myself for making mistakes. I wasn't supposed to make mistakes. I had a hard time forgiving. You know what forgiveness is? I found a really short definition that works really well for me. You know, we only have one page in the One Day at a Time book about forgiveness. It says you don't have to forgive if you hadn't judged. There you go. Forgiving means I give another chance. Just that simple. I give you another chance. And when I forgive myself, all I do is I give myself another chance. Because see, I had a real hard time about forgiving me. I like to beat me. Because you see, I should be better than that. I shouldn't have done that. I put myself above God. You know, I asked God for forgiveness, and that was fine and dandy, and God gives instant forgiveness when you ask. And he forgives it to the point he doesn't remember it anymore. I really like that part. And I found that when I truly forgive and give somebody another chance, I don't have to keep throwing it back up at them. I don't have to keep thinking about it. Love and forgiveness are qualities of a higher power. And you can't do it by yourself. I learned to give myself the right to make a mistake. And I know from experience that my higher power loves me and gives me many, many, many chances to do better. In the same areas of my life where I continue to make the same mistakes. So I found that through prayer and the ability to forgive over and over, try not to keep score on those loved ones, but give them the freedom to be human. That's all it amounts to, is giving another person the right to be a human being. This particular tradition helps you to change your whole perspective about someone, and it will make a big difference in your life in general. It's like applying the golden rule. I have found that I have had improvement in my relationships. Like even with people driving, you know, you have a relationship with a fellow driver on the road. I can be courteous to him. He can make a mistake, and I don't have to tell him what he is. I used to make a, that was a point of honor, you have to, you know, to do that. If you're going down the road and they pull in front of you and slow down, then you have to pull in front of them and slow down to show them how that felt. And then, of course, they'll have to do it to you again because they weren't aware they did it in the first place, so they've got to show you, and then you've got to show them that they can't do it, and you do it again. And then all of a sudden, they get off the freeway, and you realize that you were supposed to get off three exits ago. That's always good. But I found that, you know, when people just zip in from the side off of a side street or something, and you have to slam on your brakes and, you know, scrape yourself off the windshield and get your nervous system out of the middle of your gut, that I can say, God bless that person. God help that person. And I can say it and mean it and not be tacky with it. And to realize, Did you know, I know for me there's days when I get behind the wheel that I know that my competency level is not very well. My reflexes seem to be just a little off-center or whatever. And you know, you make little bobbles and do things. Like you'll go through the stop sign that you didn't mean to, or you'll go halfway into the intersection and slam on the brakes and it's like your brain wasn't in gear or something. Other people have that same right too. At the grocery store, my checker. I want you to know at the grocery store that I trade at, the Sack Boys give me Christmas cards. That's a miracle. I didn't know kids did that. They said, Miss Thompson, we'd love for you to come through our line. You're always so much fun. I joke with that girl at the checkout now. I make a living amends to her. And you know, I found that when I do unto her as I would like her to do unto me, she is the neatest gal. She goes out of her way to do special things for me. If there's a special on and I haven't got it in my, she'll say, did you know that so-and-so was on special? Just to make sure that I get the best benefit for my money. And that was the woman I used to fuss and cuss at the checkout. When you try to live like you would like to be living, seeing her as a child of God, it made all the difference in the world. Our experience when shared is our greatest asset because it reaffirms our program and it gives hope to others. Trying to be patient, be an uncritical listener. Are you an uncritical listener? I wasn't. When you would be talking to me, I would be finding what was wrong in what you were saying. Finding something wrong. Instead of listening to you and giving your 100% attention to that person when they're talking. Not wondering what you're going to say back, how important that is. Another habit I have, and I really have to work hard on this, is interrupting. Somebody will start and I think I know what they're going to say, and then I interrupt them. That's not very courteous. Not very kind. And a lot of times that's not what, if I'd let them finish, I'd find out it wasn't what I thought they were saying in the first place. I've learned, too, in this particular tradition that my own spiritual needs cannot be met by my partner or anyone else. God has to meet my spiritual needs. God always will do for me what I can't do. That means I've got to do what I can. You know, a lot of times people say, well, God will do for you what you can't do for yourself. And I said, yeah, but if you want taters, you've got to be willing to hold, boy. It's just that simple. Don't burden anyone else to try to do for you what you can do for yourself. No one can make you happy. You have to learn to be happy yourself. One of the keys for me on this was practice being satisfied with what I have right now. Not satisfaction doesn't come from getting what you want. It's from wanting what you get. And to realize that things are just the way they're supposed to be right now. Also, I found that to start off in a relationship, being friends is nice. Finding an area in which you can relate to. I used to start my relationships, especially with the opposite sex, in the bedroom, and it usually went downhill from there. That's not usually a good basis to start a relationship, but a lot of people do it that way. It isn't mature, and it's costly on your self-esteem, but when you're using God's love as a light instead of lust, it makes a big difference. I'm going to stop there, and we will start back with Tradition 6 after the lunch break, because it is just a few minutes before 12. Thank you.
It's been great so far. I'm looking forward to the rest of it. I have a message here for Sherry and for Ruby H., if you will get this from me. And we will resume the workshop in 1 hour.
Okay.
What time do you have?
I got about 5 to 12, so about 1:15.
So about 1:15, she thinks, will be a good time. Thank you.
Jeffrey, you're such a sweetheart. Okay. We left off at Tradition 6. A partner ought not be overly supportive, spiritually, emotionally, or physically, to the marriage or relationship, lest problems of ego gratification divert him or her from the primary purpose. Now, that's a lot of words. What does it basically say? Most of us who are in this room are the caretakers of the world, and we have a tendency to take care of someone else to the absolute distraction of all else, and usually you can tell us we're the ratty-looking ones. I can remember, when you are spending all your energy to take care of someone else, there's no time left for you. And what we have a tendency to do is to create sick relationships because we have sick dependencies. And that need to be needed will allow someone to lean on us so we can't walk either. And when we do for that, when we do for someone else what they could do for themselves, as it tells us in our literature, we make their failure to do it permanent. I didn't realize how crippling my kind of love and assistance was. Because, you see, I'm the kind of person that I will say, why don't you do so-and-so? And if you haven't done it in the next 3 seconds, I'd do it.
Because I want what I want right now, and I don't want to wait on you to do it, and I don't want you to do it your way, I want you to do it my way, and I don't want you to do it in your time frame, I want it done now, preferably 10 minutes ago. And I want it done to my standards and specifications. And if you can't do that, then by God, I'll do it. And I went around, and I was very busy. And I don't know about you, but were you tired all the time? Did you feel like that you were put upon? Why in the hell am I the only one that's doing anything in this relationship? Why is that? Well, because they've learned if they just wait a minute, they don't have to. And they can wait us out. That's right, they'll wait you out. Okay, but now my kind of love, I start this way. I can cripple you if you let me. I can make a vegetable out of you. Just give me a couple of weeks. Because in my need to be needed, my self-esteem came from doing for others. And I know now that other people enhance my life before they were my life. I didn't have a life if I wasn't doing something for somebody else. And, you know, we're taught not to be selfish people. So that means you always look to yourself last. I mean, that's what it means, doesn't it? I mean, even the book of all books said, love your neighbor as yourself. But you see, it says, as you love. If you don't love yourself and take care of yourself, you're no good to anybody else. And I didn't read it that way. I read, take care of the neighbor and you'll be okay. And that's not what it says. I did for J.D. till he could no longer do for himself. I didn't realize that. I lost respect for him, but worse yet, he lost respect for him. We had a lot of resentment. I resented doing the things that I volunteered to do. Now, that's sort of crazy when you think about it, because I can remember doing lots of things. I'd say, well, this needs to be done. He'd say, yeah, it does. And I'd say, well, when are you going to do it? He said, I don't know how. Well, I'll show you. And I did that every time. I showed him how to do the same thing time again and again. And see, he knew if he just sat there and waited long enough, I'd do that. And I didn't realize to the extent that I crippled this man. I took over our finances when we got married because I could tell he was not a mental genius, you know, with finances. Because money just seemed to get away from him. Now, you've already heard about my sprees, but you see, when you are focusing on someone else, you don't see what you're doing because your focus is tunnel vision on someone else. So I saw him as not being able to manage money. And so I took over the checkbook and our finances. I wouldn't even let him write a check. I gave him a dime to carry in his pocket for emergency phone call to call me to come financially take care of him. See, I was needed that way. And besides, I couldn't trust him with money. I knew I couldn't trust him with money. You see, those are the justifications that I used. But the bottom line was, after a while, I got tired of all this monthly hassle of sitting and looking at the bills. But he can't do it because he doesn't know how to write a check anymore. Now, this man knew how to write a check before we got married. I mean, I didn't marry him when he was 7 years old. He was 33 when we got married. And I don't know how in the hell he functioned to that point. You know, I used to sit around and think about it. I wonder how he managed till this time. And I thought he must have had some other woman taking care of him. Because God knows that women are financial geniuses. I mean, have you ever seen a man that can handle finances yet? You know, that was my arrogant attitude. I was a female chauvinist piglet. And I never wanted to have equal rights with men. I wanted us above and beyond. So I didn't realize how by taking over his responsibility, and I did it one day at a time, a little bit at a time, I began to assume responsibilities for him. And it got to the point where, you know, you take all sorts of responsibilities. I became responsible for his behavior. And part of this was, did you ever have anybody ask you, why can't you do something with him? And they say that, and you think about it, and it seems like you ought to be able to. Well, they're expecting you to. So obviously, that's something you're supposed to do. And so that began to worry me because I couldn't. But then after he got sober, now all these things that I resented doing now, remember, I resent doing them. Now he got sober and he decided he wanted to assume some responsibility. Not in this life. Give him the checkbook. Ha! You know, he had to fight for every bit of independence that he could get because it was so hard for me to let go and to allow him to do that. Because, you see, if I let him do these things, he might wake up one morning and decide he doesn't need me anymore. And there's my job security gone down the drain. And that was scary. So we do a lot of manipulation in that respect. I had to let go and I had to let him make his own mistakes. There were a lot of things that I saw him doing wrong. And it wasn't just according to the book of Mary Pearl, but I saw him doing things that I had tried many times and they don't work. And I knew that it was pointless to try to point that out. And instead, I'd sit back and love him enough to let him have the dignity to fail. And there is dignity in failure because you learn what doesn't work by trying it. And I could have told him all day long, and I would have robbed him of the opportunity of learning, because people tell me all the time, and nothing ever registers with me till I do it myself. I have to do it myself. And then if it works, it works. Or then if it doesn't work, I only try it 75 more times. Okay, I had to develop a hands-off policy and mind my own business. And boy, that was hard because, see, I felt like everything he did was my business. And it was very difficult to let go of that. So I put signs all over the house that said, MYOB, mind your own business. I put them everywhere. And when he would say something, I did. You know, I felt obligated to respond to every sentence that he uttered. He would make a statement about something, and I would have to tell him how I thought about it. And one day he asked me, he said, who asked you for your opinion? And I said, well, I have a right to it. He said, yeah, you sure do, but keep it to yourself. And then I realized opinions unasked for are rarely used, you know, so you might as well forget that one. So I put up the signs at the house and the car in my car because, you see, I had a tendency, I couldn't let him drive. Now, he'd be behind the wheel, but I couldn't let him drive. Now, you need to turn right up here. And I'd give him mixed messages, he called it. I'd tell him to turn left right here. And then he'd stop in the middle of the intersection and say, what in the hell way you want me to go here? And see, the only way to get to places was the way I went. That was the only way to go. And it never occurred to me we could get there if he drove. We could go there a different way. And see, he follows cars closer than I do. He lets the people behind him drive for him because he's worrying so much about the person in the rearview mirror all the time, what they're going to do. And he drives defensively against the guy behind him that always worried me. And finally, I had to realize that when I got in the car, I let go and let God and J.D. drive the car. And if it cracks up, it cracks up. And he hasn't had any wrecks, I thank God for that. He's not as bad as I thought he was, obviously. But he has also learned some things that don't work, and he learned it by doing it and not by me telling him not to do it. You know, when you went the wrong way 17 times to get there, when he got lost coming home from my mother who lives about 8 blocks from us, he has a rotten sense of direction. And I would constantly try to give him the directions so that he wouldn't screw up. And I found out that, you know, it's better for him to go ahead and screw up and then let him ask. Because when he asks, he will follow. When I told him, he didn't follow. In fact, I told him one night we were going home, and he said, you think I'm on the wrong road? Well, I didn't think it. I knew it. I lived there all my life. I know where my mama lives, you know. And so we pulled up in the yard, and he looked at us and he said, who stole the brick? Because we pulled up in a place in a frame house. Just stuff like that. And it's hard to let go. And it'd be just like, you know, I treated him like a child. And it's hard to see your children make mistakes. It's hard to see them. Because, see, I consider that a reflection against me. And, you know, if I'd have been a better wife, he wouldn't have done that. But, you see, I had a mother role with him. He was not a little child. He's 7 years older than I am. He ought to know these things. But he never had to do them because I did them for him. No one can meet all the needs of another person. And our separateness has become our mutual strength. We're supportive of one another, but we don't do for each other what we can do for ourselves. Now, there's such a thing as common courtesy. You know, you can carry anything to an extreme. Now, if I'm going into the kitchen to get me a glass of water, it doesn't hurt me to say, honey, would you like a glass of water? That's not keeping him where he can never get water. Because every time I go in the kitchen, I do not go for water. You know? Or if he's going past going into the kitchen, I can say, honey, would you get me a glass of water? Now, if he's going to be tacky, he'll say, I'm not going to do for you. You can do for yourself. You can get off yourself and get up and go get the water. See, now that's tacky. But there is such a thing as he say, honey, I'm not coming back here. I'm going on outside. And see, that's not doing for me what I can do for myself. But you have to use common courtesy in that, too. Don't get real carried away, as we have a tendency to do. I had to give him and encourage him to grow at his own pace. Now, it was real difficult. Did you feel like if you left the house and were gone, say, for 2 or 3 weeks, what would they do? Well, I decided I wanted to go on a vacation with my sister, and we were going to go to Hawaii. And we were going to spend 3 weeks in Hawaii. And I thought, there's no way I can leave him for 3 weeks. He can't cook anything but hot dogs. He might get tired of those in 3 weeks. Did you know it never occurred to me he'd have sense enough to go to a restaurant? That's what I'm saying. You get so into something, you don't think that they can take care of themselves. And I thought, well, what if something goes wrong with the house? The what ifs. And I talked to my sponsor, and she said, you're going to have to turn that over and let go and let God and go have your vacation. And I thought, how can I do that? And I knew that I was in trouble. Because, see, I had created this dependency. Who was going to pay the bills while I was gone? Well, obviously, J.D. was going to. What if something went wrong? He was going to have to handle it. He didn't know how. What was he going to do? And as my sponsor pointed out, that wouldn't be my problem. I would be in Hawaii. Well, I knew it'd be my problem if I talked to him. Because all he, you know, have you ever noticed how we play that game with the alcoholic? They have a problem. They tell you. You take the problem. They walk off scot-free. And you got a problem. You ever notice that? They're masters at doing that. And we are so stupid. We get zipped in, they call it fast talking for slow thinking. You know, we get that every time. So I told him, I said, what do you think about it? He said, I think it'd be nice for your sister to go. Her husband had recently died, and she had never gone anywhere, done anything. And he said, go ahead and go with her and have a good time. So Dorothy and I went to Hawaii. And when we left that morning, needless to say, I was apprehensive about leaving him. Because I was afraid, what if something happens, he can't handle it, and he'll get drunk. You know how we are. Those thoughts go through your mind. It took me a long time in the program before I gave up the fear of what if he got drunk. If he gets drunk, that's his problem. How I deal with it is my problem. Now, when I got to Honolulu, I called him and I said, we are here. We are safe. I will see you when I get home. And I hung up. And I didn't call for 15 days. And I didn't call because I wasn't curious, or I didn't call because I didn't care. But I knew if I called and there was a problem, he'd tell me. And then I'd try to handle it from Honolulu. So I did what I had to do for me, and that was not call. And that was the hardest thing, because we had never been separated more than two or three nights at a time when he would run off and escape when he was drinking and disappear. And so there he was. And not only that, we left him in charge of mother. Now that ought to be enough to that's the blind leading the blind, I can tell you. And I left him in charge of my dogs, too, and that was precious, too. And I just thought, what's going to happen? Well, I want to tell you, everything that could go wrong did. Things happened that just never happened at our house. The attic fan motor burned up, and it was in the summertime. The air conditioning unit quit. The washer broke. The dryer belt came off. The refrigerator, the defrost unit in the refrigerator died, and all the food, they lost it in the shuffle. And do you know what he did? He did what any red-blooded alcoholic would do. He called another Al-Anon. I'm sure you've heard, I will go to the hills, the source from which my help cometh. He went to Al-Anon, the source from which his help cometh. He said that he knew if he could find another manager and controller, he'd have it made. And did you know one of the girls I sponsored was sick enough to help him? Well, what she did was she said, Mary Pearl has a Rolodex. And on that Rolodex is a card that covers everything from eyelashes to toenails. She said, there's something on there that will tell you what to do in the case of. Because I do have all the different, the people I call for certain kinds of repairs and things. And so when I got home, he told me, he said, you know, I was never so embarrassed in my life as to have to call someone outside the walls of this house to find out how this house operates. He said, I had never sat down and taken the initiative to say, look, I'm a partner here and I want to know, what do you do when this goes wrong and that wrong? How do you handle it? He said, I was so used to you just handling everything. And so I sat down with him and I showed him on my Rolodex, when this goes wrong, he said, well, I found that out finally. And he said, but I want to sit down with you. And he said, we're going to have some discussions about how this house operates. And that was when J.D. became a partner in the house. And you see, he could never have done that unless I let go. And I had to detach myself physically from that home in order to turn that over to him. And I had to have an enticement that was bigger, which was the trip to Hawaii. You know, I wanted to go, and I wanted to have a good time. And did you know I had a good time? But each day, I had to turn over that situation that was back home, because I didn't know what it was, but I had to turn it over. And if I'd called and found out all that stuff was going wrong, I would have ruined my trip in Hawaii, because I would have been trying to figure it out, wondering if they was going to gyp us this, wondering how he was going to find time to get the repairman over there with his work schedule. And see, I didn't have to manipulate, control, manage any of that. And it was sort of defeating. You know, I found out it wasn't as necessary as I thought I was. But it was also freedom. It was freedom for me. And, you know, if I didn't have the freedom to be able to walk away as much as I am gone, it would be a heck of a mess at my house. But you see, I trust my husband now, because it was by letting him do it and make mistakes and learn how to do it right that I can go away with the freedom inside of me that everything's going to be okay and I don't have to worry about it. because I know he can take care of himself. You know, when we are so making a cripple out of the other person without realizing, when you let somebody lean on you, you've got to bend sideways too. You can't stand up straight if somebody's leaning on you. If they're putting, the more weight they put on you, the more they bend. And the tragedy to this is, when either one of you move, you're both going to fall down. And so our separateness is our strength. When we go together, we're not crutches for one another. Because in that overly dependent situation, you are a prey for sick relationships when you do that. Our best relationship is where our dependence is mutual, our independence is equal, and our obligation is reciprocal. This means that we're a partnership. We depend upon one another from time to time, yet we are independent. We can stand alone and be okay by ourselves. And our obligation to one another is to give and a take in a loving way. There's balance in that relationship. If I drop dead, J.D. can be okay. If he drops dead, I can be okay. But we choose to be together to enhance our relationship, not because we have to be there. And if somebody goes from your life, that doesn't mean you won't miss them, and a part of your love is going to be with them forever. But you are not going to be so stymied that you cannot function on a day-to-day basis after your initial period of grief is over in a situation. And that's like, if I have to live without someone in my life, I can. That person, I love them being there. I love their presence being in my life. But they're not necessary for my life because my God will put in my life what I need, not another person. And that's what I have come to believe. Being totally dependent on another person isn't living, and it's not love either. You may try to call it that, but it is not love. It's being a leech. And if you're not careful, you can allow someone to be a leech and to suck the lifeblood and energy out of you, or you can do that to another person with your clinging. You know, I hate that whiny, clinging type thing. And at one time, that was music to my ears. Because, you know, I'm going to be needed here. And now that scares me to death because I know that that is one of the things for me. I don't know how to do that real well to help somebody and not kill them. And I have learned through sponsorship. That has been one of the greatest tools for me, was to be able to help another person but not do it for them. To sit back and let them do it, and if they don't do it, love them anyway. If you can't be responsible for yourself, you will never be an equal in your relationships. If you can't be responsible for yourself. And that's what the next tradition, Tradition 7, is all about. Each person ought to strive to be fully self-supporting, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. All that time I was so busy helping everybody else, I let myself go. I let my personal needs go. And all of a sudden, when I stopped trying to be all things to all people, I had more than enough time. There was hours and hours of, what am I going to do now? Because taking care of other people is a full-time job. And now all of a sudden, and I didn't know how to be good to me. I didn't know how to take care of myself. See, I was dependent on that other person. When you're the caretaker, you're dependent on someone to take care of. And when that person started being a person instead of an extension of myself, when I began to let go of that person and not be overly supportive, then I had time to work on myself. Now, in our home, we are both independent people, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. And that was a long time in coming. And there's still areas that we improve upon. You know, we believe in progress rather than perfection. I have to watch out for being the controller. See, I control through those finances that I held on to, that checkbook. I had to learn to let go of that. And the way we do that now, J.D. will tell me, he said, I don't like sitting down and paying bills. As far as sitting down, right? He said, I want to know where our money's going. So what we do is, twice a month, we sit down, we discuss the bills, we look at them, and we talk about them, and I physically write out the checks. He can physically write out the checks. He just says, I like for you to do it. And that's fine. We're working together. But I know that he can. And before, I didn't trust him to do it because I felt like he couldn't. So you see, we've achieved a balance in that. When taking care of others, I always feel put upon. Whenever you get that feeling, you're feeling put upon, realize you have done it to you. You have allowed someone else to put upon you. You know, God never puts on you more than you can stand, but you'll do it every time. And when you allow that person to put upon you, that's your fault. That's not theirs. You have to learn to say no. And I had resentment because of that. I had fear, and I had a lot of self-pity. I was so put upon. Bessie's heart, poor widow to me. But I know now I'm responsible for my own growth, just as J.D.'s responsible for his. And first of all, spiritually, J.D. and I do not have the same faith or beliefs. And that's okay. I have mine, and he has his. He does his worship in his way. I do mine in my way. I don't try to make him conform to what I consider mine. It's nice when you both have the same, but it is not necessary in order to have a good relationship. Another thing I found about me when I was doing this, about being independent, I had a very, very important job in a major insurance company, and my job was my identity. I didn't know that. And when I quit work, somehow or another, I felt lesser, because I didn't have the strokes that I got from the position that I had. And I no longer had an identity. Now I know that somebody works a job, but one is not a job. You know, the job is a job title, but it's not me. It's not who. And my ego was out of whack, and that makes it a painful lesson, because when your good strokes come from what you're doing instead of who you are, it makes you very vulnerable. All right, I was someone's higher power. That's a real tiring job. When you're being the manager and controller, when you take over the care, you know, J.D. used to turn his will and his life over to my care each day. I demanded it. I said in the sponsorship, there's only one thing I demand from people I sponsor, and that's total obedience. I don't get it. I just demand it a lot. But you see, when you become someone's higher power and you do for them what they should do for themselves, then you have to take the responsibility for the enabling and the crippling that comes. That's your fault. When you sit there and allow someone to do that, that's your fault. When you participate in that sickness. When we are dependent upon someone else for our well-being, then we're going to be praying for that sick relationship. We're going to be right out there asking for it. Having a man in my life to make me okay was one of those patterns that I had set a long time before I ever met an alcoholic. My father and I had a fantastic relationship, and when my father died when I was 12, I began to seek that same type of wonderful relationship I had with a father with everybody I had, always comparing them to the father, which means that they're always going to come up short. And so I felt like that, you know, this was a super type relationship, and I looked for it and looked for it and couldn't have it. And I realized now that the relationship that the daughter has with a father is a special relationship, and you're not supposed to have that same kind of relationship with a husband or a mate. That's the reason they have fathers. You know, but I always wanted that, what I wanted mainly out of the relationship was what my father did. He let me have my way. That's what I come to find out. I never released someone in my life till I had someone to replace them, whether it was a male or not. I never got rid of a friendship and left myself vulnerable just out there. When I would meet, I don't know about you, but I had one friend at a time. And you give everything to that one relationship that you have. It's the big relationship, whether it be my relationship with my little girlfriend, Shirley. And I didn't want to share her with anybody, because, see, I didn't have anybody but Shirley. So if Shirley had somebody else, then I was going to lose, and I could see that. It never occurred to me to develop more than one relationship at a time, because, see, I give everything, give my all into the one situation. So I call myself a giving person, but I was, but only on my own terms. I give what I wanted to, when I wanted to whom I wanted to. And I love to martyr and manage at the same time. But I was always looking for control, because I always felt out of control. And you can't give what you don't have. You can't give security if you don't have any yourself. You can't give peace of mind if you don't have any for yourself. You can't transmit what you don't have. And I didn't know that. So I wasn't taking care of my own needs. And that's what this tradition is all about, taking care of my own needs. And I think it's well for us to know what our capabilities are, as well as our limitations. You know, I do not work out of the home today. And that was a very difficult thing to give up, because, like I say, I gave up my job title, I gave up my financial independence, and all these things. But I still have the same skills. And that's what I had to realize, that, you know, if J.D. dies today, I will have to go back to work. That's a fact of life. But I recognize that I am not in that relationship because he's taking care of me. Because I can take care of myself. I have skills and abilities that I can take care of myself outside that relationship. So I think it's well for any of us to have skills and things that we can fall back on in case something happens. Because that way you're not going to be dependent on that person for your well-being. Physically, you can take care of yourself. And I think a lot of times we stay in situations because we feel financially we can't. Say, well, I don't have an education, and I can't do it. Well, what are you sitting down about? Why aren't you going back to school? Why aren't you getting your education? It's an easy cop-out to sit there and say, I don't have any skills. Why don't you develop some? God gave everybody gifts. And it's your obligation to find out what your gifts are and develop them. Because God never made nerds. But my God never made nerds. I also had to let go of a controlling attitude. It wasn't just physically doing it, but with an attitude that I had in my mind. Because, see, in my mind, I felt like if something was good for me, then it ought to be good for everybody else. And so then I would try to make them see that. But that's not necessarily the case, because each of us have our own ideas and our own ways, and there's lots of roads to roam. It doesn't have to be your path. They can all get there going at their own way. My first responsibility to myself is to my higher power, to be the best self I can be spiritually. I have to take responsibility for that. I have to do my own reading. I have to do my own meditating. I have to do my own study regarding my beliefs and what have you. That is mine. It's not anybody else's responsibility. I don't have to teach anybody else. All I have to do is be taught what I want and the way that I want to get it. I can do that by going and participating with people who believe like I do. I had to take responsibility for my health. You see, I always blame this on him. We don't have any money for me to go to the doctor. I need to go to the dentist, but I can't afford to go. The bottom line was, I wouldn't have gone to the dentist if we had $17 million. I was afraid of the dentist. That was the truth. You see, I lied a lot to myself about the situations and why I was the way I was. I blamed him, and I said, we can't afford medical bills. Well, I can tell you that today, I go to the dentist regularly, every 6 months. I asked God to relieve me of the fear of dentists, and God did. And it was the most remarkable thing, you know, that's part of your spiritual contact working on, see, if I would take care of myself spiritually, then I can take care of myself physically. Because God gave me what I needed to take care of myself physically. I looked in the phone book one day. A filling had fallen out of my tooth when I was at the hospital emergency room with my mother, that they thought she was having a heart attack at the time. And when that filling fell out, I had not been to a dentist in 25 years. Now, God blessed me with good teeth. He knew I was going to be a chicken. And we had determined that it was not a heart attack she was having and that they were just going to observe her. And so I went on home. And I looked in the phone book because, you know, I've learned if you do what you've always done, you get what you've always got. Now, what I've always done is I will sit there and let it hurt until I can't stand any hot in my mouth. And then I'll go till I can't stand any cold in my mouth. And then I'll go till I can't stand my tongue in my mouth. And then I'll go to the dentist and he will pull what's left of the tooth and throw it away. Because I will have let it abscess and completely ruin by not taking care of it. And so I decided this time I'm going to do something different. And I said, God, I want to do different this time. Please find me a dentist. You know how afraid I am. Don't let them hurt me. And I open up the phone book and there's an ad right in front of my face that says, we cater to cowards. And so I call, and I know that, you know, I'm a stranger, I'm not a regular customer, so the chances of being worked in, and she said, we'll take you right now, come. And I really wasn't ready to go right now, but I know now that was part of God's plan, because if you give me a day or two, I might have chickened out, see, and lost the tooth again. So I got in my car, and I drove over to this place, and it was at the top of a set of stairs. And I looked, and there was a major highway out there, and I thought, now I've got a choice. I can go throw myself into the traffic. I can go up those stairs. Oh, God, help me to get up those stairs. And I walked, and so I ran the stairs, which I normally don't do that because I've got a bad knee, but I ran the stairs to get up there before I chickened out. And I went in and I sat down, and they had the music system playing, and they were doing a local FM station where my grandbaby in sponsorship just happened to be the disc jockey. And all of a sudden I heard Ann's voice, and she was saying, have a good day. And there was something about that was very calming. See, God gave me just exactly what I needed. I went in there and I sat down in the chair to get the x-ray, and when she flipped me back on the ceiling was a little poster, and it said, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change. Now, none of them there are alcoholic, but I can tell you one thing, they were there for me. And God put exactly, because I felt peace in that chair. And I went in there and I told him, I said, you can write down, I'm super chicken. I am son of chicken. I am super chicken. And I said, I was hurt very badly when I was a child by a dentist. And I said, I have been terrified all my life. And he said, well, if I hurt you at all, he said, I'm going to let you hold on to my arm the whole time. And all you have to do is put pressure on my arm. And he never hurt me to this day. And I have been going back every 6 months. And when the card comes to go, I look forward to it because it's like a family over there now. They're real sweet to me. We laugh, we joke, we talk. And it's just like, you know, it's not fearful for me anymore. And you see, God did that for me so that I could take care of myself physically. I was going to a doctor I had gone to for years, and he was treating me for high blood pressure, and I was on probably about 6 or 7 different kinds of medication for blood pressure at that time. I felt tired all the time. My potassium was always drug out. And my doctor died. And I began to shop for a new doctor, and I got this other one. I didn't really like him, but he was close. You know, it was convenient. You know how we are. And all of a sudden, you know, I was trying to go back and get my pills refilled. And the massive bunch of bottles that I took. And there was a sign on the office, and it said, we're closed for remodeling. If you have an emergency, go to the emergency room. And I thought, well, that sure is tacky. They knew I had an appointment, and they did that, and so it made me mad. Well, see, sometimes getting mad can be good because it forced a change, and I decided that I would do something different. And so I prayed about it, and I found this other doctor. I went over there, and he said, honey, you've got so many drugs in your system for blood pressure, it's no wonder that you're tired and you're this and you're that, and I've been on a diuretic for 10 years. He took me off all of that, put me on one pill, made me start walking. And I didn't want to walk because I'm lazy. And so I got one of my pigeons, and I said, you need to lose weight. I'm just going for my blood pressure. I don't know about you. And I said, let's go walking. And she said, okay. And so we would walk, and we found that when we walked, if we were mad, we could walk and really get off the anger. But we found, too, that that was a good time for people that we were mad at. We prayed for them when we walked. We would say, God bless so-and-so, and she would say, God bless this person. And we blessed people for 5 miles a day. And did you know that my blood pressure got down with one little pill to 130 over 70? See, you know, God was showing me that I could take care of myself if I would do it. And so he put these things in my way to direct me to where I needed to go. And that's what I'm saying. So many times the things that you see that happen that make you mad or aggravating are really God's doing his thing. Because just because when you pray about it and you don't see any action doesn't mean God's not working on it. Because he never does it like I think he's going to. And it's just amazing to me. Anyway, I make my own doctor's appointments. They're on a regular schedule. I don't wait around to see if something's going to happen. I go in regularly and take care of myself now. I'm also responsible for my feelings. There's no blaming anymore. And I don't know about you, but I was a big why person. Did you ever wonder why? God, I wanted to know why all my life. I remember my first question into mother, and she'd say, you can't go down to so-and-so's, and I'd say, why? And she'd say, because I said so. And believe me, that is no answer at all. To a kid with an inquisitive mind, that is no answer. And see, I figured out why I always wanted to know why. If you tell me why, then I can figure out where you're coming from and I can head you off at the pass to get my way. See, if she told me why I didn't need to go there, I could have told her why I did need to go there. So I found out that I don't need the whys all the time. It doesn't make any difference. You know, it's like a friend of mine in AA, Clancy, has an illustration about the why. He said, if you were on the Titanic, and they tell you to get off, the Titanic is sinking. He said, there'll be that group that'll stand there and say, I wonder why we're sinking. Now, the rest of them are getting in the lifeboat. And they'll sit there, and they'll continue to think and figure out why we were sinking. And then all of a sudden, somebody says, we hit an iceberg. Oh. And they drown. But they figured it out. You see, figuring it out doesn't change a darn thing. So it doesn't make any difference how your horse got in the mud. Get his ass out. And that was my responsibility. I would sit around and determine why I was the way I was instead of doing something about it. Because it's not that important. When you start doing something different about it, you'll find out where it was that you wasn't. You'll find what it was you weren't doing before. And then you'll know why. And then you'll tell us and we'll all be thrilled. Okay, tradition eight. Our marriage or relationship should remain forever a free giving relationship, one to the other. Do you keep score? I do. I didn't know I did. If I did something good for you, in my subconscious, I must have made a note of it. Because maybe 3 years from today, there come a situation when you can return the favor. And I tell you, and you don't. And I'll say, you rat think. Don't you know 3 years ago I did this for you? Now, a gift is a free thing. I always remember when I'd get gifts from my mother. I hated to get gifts from my mother because my mother never gave me a free gift. My mother always gave me a gift with instructions. She would say, here is this. Now, if you don't like it, don't give it away. And here's this, and this is what you do with it. And you don't use it on this day, and you use it on that day, and you don't do this with it, and you don't do that with it. And I just wish the hell she hadn't given me nothing. My mother would give me money for Christmas, and she'd say, now, I don't want you to buy this with it, and I don't want you to buy that with it, and I don't want you to buy this with it, but you can buy this with it. Well, I didn't want that. So that wasn't a gift. See, a gift to me was something that was free, without any strings. And so that was when I would do something for somebody. I never thought about the fact that I was giving them a gift and that I should do it without the strings or expectations. So on that conscious level, I wasn't aware I was doing that until the time came. When the time was to pay back, and I didn't get it. And I can remember telling my partner, I don't know about you, but I'll tell him, honey, it's your turn to do this. I've done it the last 4 times. And he'd just look at me. You know, like for instance, take a job in the house. Or something like carrying out the garbage. Honey, would you carry out the garbage? God, I'm so tired, I've done it the last 26 times. Now, how would I know it's 26 times if I wasn't keeping score? You know, those kind of things. Instead of doing something because you wanted to, not because you wanted to keep score for it. I was real bad about this. This came up with a lot of things in our home. And sometimes major rifts would come as a result of this. This would be the catalyst that would start the argument. This kind of blaming and telling him in so many words, when I would tell him that, what I'm saying is, you're not doing your job around here. And it was a blaming technique that I used, and I didn't realize I was doing that. I've learned that I receive freely. I receive freely of God's unconditional love. And when you get something like that, such a precious thing is the kind of love that we have from our higher power. You know, he gives it to me regardless if I do my chores. He gives it to me regardless of what I do. I receive love, and I receive freely from this program. And you know, sometimes, like for instance, when I was invited to come and talk at the Alpha group here several years ago, they asked me in the beginning, they said, what do you charge? What honorarium do you want? And I was really surprised, because you see, I was given this program for free, and I can't see charging for what was given to me. If it's given to me as a gift, I have a responsibility to pass on freely what I give and not to charge for that. I've got some friends in the fellowship that do charge for going places. It's amazing to me. That's their choice. That's not mine. I'm not going to judge them for it. I just don't understand them. I feel like if I started charging for what I have been given, that I'd have to pay from now on. And I could never have the money to pay for what I have been given to this date. I would, if I had $1 million a day, I wouldn't have enough for what the program has given me. The first relationship I was able to practice this tradition with was with my sponsor. And I didn't even realize it at the time. The first Christmas after I was in the program, I came in the program of January of that year, and when Christmas time, I began to think about what to give my sponsor for Christmas. She had given me so much of her time, so much of her love, and I wanted to repay her and say thank you, because I loved her. And all of her encouragement, everything. And I couldn't think of what to give her. I could not think of what to give her. Anything I felt like to give her, it just didn't seem enough. And so I decided, well, if you want to know, just ask her. So I went up to her and I said, LaBelle, what would you like for Christmas? I said, I love you so much and I want to give you something that you would really like to have. And she looked at me and she said, honey, don't give me anything. I've already gotten from giving to you. And I didn't understand what she was talking about. She said, I gave freely to you and it's already been given back to me. You just pass it on somewhere else. Now, that's what I've been trying to do, but what I found out is, you know, when you give and you give and you give and you feel like you're not getting anything back, you're giving. You know, there is a spiritual law that says, whatever you sow, you're going to reap. When I give good, I'm going to get good. I may be good to Jeffrey over here, and Jeffrey may be a mean dog to me, but Sue's going to be good to me. And you see, I'm going to get back from Sue what I gave to Jeffrey. What I used to do, I used to look back over here and say, Jeffrey, what's the matter with you? Why aren't you giving it to me? And she's giving it to me all the time, and I'm not seeing it because I'm looking at it from him. So what you sow is going to come back. It may not come back from the person you give it to, but it's going to come back to you. And when I realize how much good, when I want something good to happen to me, I go do something good for somebody because I know it's going to come back to me. And that may be selfish, but it still works. Spiritual principles work even if you work them for the wrong reasons. Because you feel good when you're helping somebody else. When I have somebody that I'm working with that's in a lot of pain and I can give them that love and help them over those hard spots, I know they're there for me. And they have been there for me because there have been many hard spots in the years that I have been in recovery. There have been many, many hard spots. J.D. had cancer. That was a hard one to go through. J.D. and I have had problems in our marriage and relationship prior to when we started doing this. That's one of the things that necessitated this. We have gone through those. We've had problems with my family. We've had problems with his family. We have problems with the house. We've had problems. We have lost loved ones. And the program and the people in the program have been there to carry us through these times. There will always be somebody to carry you when you can't. God will do for you what you can't do for yourself. And he will put the people there to carry you when you can't walk. But that doesn't mean that when you're able to walk that you should still lean. Then it's your turn to carry. You take turns. Giving and receiving. Have you ever had a problem with receiving? What do you do when somebody says, that's a beautiful dress, Joyce? This whole thing I got at Kmart last week for $3.97. I had this for 25 years. Instead of saying, thank you. Isn't it simple? All you have to do when you receive is just say, thank you. You don't have to make a big deal. You don't have to justify your being. You just say, thank you. And so we had an exercise on our in our group one time for about 3 weeks. Every time, and we would be real calm and, to compliment one another, just waiting. And the minute they'd say, well, we'd say, thank you. Thank you. And we got to where we could do it and say, thank you. And it makes, because when you start cutting it down, when somebody has complimented you, what you're telling that person is their taste is shot. You know, or you're stupid. Don't you realize this is a piece of junk? You know. Instead of accepting, you know, the giver can't get any good out of giving if the receiver won't receive. Did you get that? Under this tradition, I also reinforce my unconditional acceptance and love of others. My self-worth, like I said, came from my job, and my self-worth today comes from the fact that I'm a child of God. I don't need anything else to make me an okay person. I'm God's kid today. I don't always act like I'm God's kid. But you know, God loves me anyway and hopes that I will do better. My self-worth diminished by making expectations of self and others. When I expect you to do something for me and you didn't, I felt less of a person. Because if I were worthy, you would have done it. That's how I looked at it. I put all my self-esteem in the hands of others. Shame on me. Not shame on them. Shame on me. You know, we have role models in life. And when I was growing up, Father Knows Best was on, and later on, Leave It to Beaver, you know, and you see these perfect little happy little live-after families. And I had endless hours of wondering what happened at our house. Why weren't we like that? It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference what your role model was. You can overcome that. To me, one of the biggest things about the program is strictly just growing up. Quit being a child. Quit fantasizing about what could be, and instead, enjoy what you got right here and right now. And when I got into relationships, I expected mind reading. Why didn't that happen for me? I never communicated my needs to my partner. I just expected him or anybody else in any other relationship, just expect them to know why. And I kept score. I did the judging. You know, on God's score sheet, there was nothing there because God doesn't keep score. God keeps giving and giving and giving, just like forgiving and forgiving and forgiving. It doesn't make any difference. And practice of the steps in your life is the best way I know of not keeping score. Bondage of self and self-centeredness is diminished, and loving without expectations is easier. Because, you know, like I say, a mother loves regardless. Most mothers love regardless. But if we want freedom, we must also give freedom. And we let somebody be free when we take the word if off of them. If only you'd done this. If only you'd do that. I could love you if. That's not loving for free. We love in spite of. If people hadn't loved me in spite of myself, I would never have been loved. And the first love I ever felt since my daddy died was when y'all accepted me. When I went into a room of complete strangers and they accepted me just like I was, it was the greatest form of love I had ever known. Unconditionally. Regardless. Not because I deserved it, but because they were capable of loving me. And they loved me long enough till I could love me. My security and serenity comes from my higher power, not from my partner. Not from my relationship. When I enter the relationship, I bring these qualities with me, and that enhances my relationship. When I bring in unconditional love, when I bring in serenity, when I bring in security, I take those things in with me. If I don't take them in with me, I'm not going to get them there. I have to have them in order to take them. I used to charge J.D. for loving him. I want him to let me have my way. It was a very expensive relationship for him, and it was a very sick one for us both. He got little for his investment, I can tell you. But giving freely today makes me feel good on the inside. Not having to have recognition for doing so is even better. When I can do things for free and not get found out, it's even better. Tradition 9. A family or relationship should be pliable in its organization. But our group conscience may appoint certain persons responsible to serve in various functions. An atmosphere of acceptance and freedom are wonderful in which to live. However, this is something we have to work on each and every day, because growth is not done as a unit, but as individuals. And each person grows at their own pace. Now, when living or functioning together, we're going to see a need to come up with some mutually agreed upon guidelines. Guidelines for acceptable conduct within that relationship. as well as establishing responsibility for items that arise in day-to-day living. So, in our home, we came up with the following list of guidelines for acceptable behavior or conduct for either one of us, and I'm going to read just a few of those to you. First one was no infidelity. We both had experienced this in past relationships, and we found it very damaging. So that's one of the rules for acceptable conduct, is that there will be no infidelity in our home. We made an agreement that at any point in time when somebody else looked better to us than what we had, that we would come to that partner and we would talk about it and we would dissolve the partnership at that point, rather than to suffer the pain and the humiliation of having to sit there and find out from somebody else that your husband or wife is sleeping with someone else. We just found that that was a guideline that we wanted to live by. This one was one for me. No expenditures of $50, over $50, without consultation prior to purchase. This stopped impulse buying, because the financial problem did create problems within our relationship. And so when I agreed that I would not spend more than $50 without consultation prior to, you'd be surprised how your finances improved. You'd be surprised. No alcohol on our premises. Now, like I say, these are just for us, not for anybody else. These were our guidelines. I don't care anything about alcohol, and J.D. said he certainly doesn't need to have alcohol. And we have seen a lot of people say, well, we keep it in our home for other people. And then, lo and behold, at some point somebody has a slip, and where did they first start drinking? They went to the supply for other people. So we just decided that we're not putting ourselves in a position to get hurt. And so when people come and they say, do you mind if we bring some beers in? We say, yeah, we sure do. Because in our home, we don't have alcohol. That way, we know at any time, anyone in this fellowship can come into our home and not be threatened by alcohol, be they the drinker or the non-alcoholic, either one. No obligations or commitments without prior agreement. In other words, we don't commit our partners to things without them having the right to say so. Personal privacy and quiet time. Individual space. Each one of us has our individual space and quiet time that we take each day to be with our higher power. And we do not interrupt the other person when they are in their quiet time or their space. A special hour time each week. Thursday night is our date. J.D. and I have a date each Thursday night. And if I'm not in town that particular Thursday, well, we will have it on Wednesday or whatever before I go. But we have one night a week that is just strictly our date. And if we want to go out to eat, or if we don't want to go out to eat, whatever we want to do, we decide what we're going to do for that night. And it does not include other people necessarily. We don't make a date and then invite other couple to join us. We have this just for the two of us. We found that a lot of times we can just go to the park and hold hands and walk. We can go window shopping. In the shopping centers. I get a lot of fun out of window shopping nowadays without having to buy. That's something different. Of course, I got his hand holding on to me. And you know, the funny part about that is more often than I have told his hand to keep him from going in. It's really funny how that has changed. We can sit down and we can talk. We can go down to the lake. We can go to a movie. We can sit in the same room and read different things at the same time and be together and have a space between us, but we are held together by that space. We can be at peace and contentment, not doing anything, but enjoying the pleasure of each other's company. But it is special time, and I don't want telephone calls. I don't want to be bothered, so I have my answering machine that takes those calls. I don't necessarily answer the door. If we want to have whoopee, we have whoopee. I mean, it doesn't make any difference. We are free to do at that particular thing whatever feels good for us as a unit, and we do not have to worry about anything else. Common courtesy is a rule in our home. We say thank you, and we say please. It's a little thing, but it means a lot. J.D. will say, kitten, will you do something for me, please? Thank you, J.D. It's a very small thing, but used to, I gave orders. Do this, do that. I never said, would you, and please, never once. It was just assumed that you would follow the directions. He told me, he said, you may manage all those people at the office, but they're not paying me to obey you here. And see, that was a good point. It worked, they did pay them to obey me. But it didn't work that way, and I had a tendency to bring that attitude home with me and try to apply it at home. And I found, too, that was another thing, was I liked for J.D. to leave work at work. And I don't want to have to hear what so-and-so at work did and what this one did or that did, unless it's something comical or whatever. I don't hear his bitching and complaining about his job. He has a sponsor he can talk to. And that's another thing we do, is we try not to dump garbage on one another, but use our sponsors for that. Mm-hmm. Okay? The autonomous action that we take is measured by the negative effect on our relationship. That's what I've agreed on. That we will measure about with any autonomous action by the effect that it has on our relationship. And we try to apply the rules of communication that are outlined in the Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, the 5 rules of communication. We try to practice those when we talk. Discuss, don't attack. Keep your voice low and quiet. See, that's real hard because I'm loud by nature and I'm a screamer by nature, so it's very hard for me to, when I'm trying to communicate without trying to overdo my side. You know, I call it enthusiasm when it's just trying to, battling with my bull. Okay? Then we took normal jobs and duties within the home, and we made lists of all the jobs and duties in running a house and home, and what are your preferences? You know, like saying these role models, I thought that men were supposed to do this. I knew the woman was supposed to cook and to clean the house and everything else the man was supposed to do. I mean, you just know that's the way it is, don't you? In other words, they do things you don't want to do. Isn't that right? Well, we didn't find that so in our house. And then as time went on, I developed a physical problem where I have a back problem where it's just very painful to push a vacuum cleaner over the heavy carpet. And so J.D. said, I tell you what. He said, if you'll help me with some of the watering of the flowers on the patio. See, his area of responsibility by his preference is the outside. Mine is the inside. All right, I help him and we negotiate. I take care of the plants on the patio, plus I get the garbage cans, the empty ones, in off the street, because he can't stand to see garbage cans out on the street when the garbage man has gone past. He's very picky about how his yard looks. And you know, I'm not that picky, but I enjoy the hell out of a pretty looking yard. I'm not going to tell you. If it was left up to me to do it, we might have to have a map to find the front door. Because I'm allergic to fresh cut grass. I have a big problem with that. But anyway, like I say, he does that. But now these are things that I do, and he runs the vacuum for me. And I don't have to say, J.D., today's the day I want you to run the vacuum. I leave that alone, and I let him do it when he chooses to do it. And if I don't like it when he's done it, I can hire somebody to come over and do it. But I am not going to bitch at him about it. And that was another thing, was to allow people to do it on their own schedule. And we're flexible. Sometimes if he's not there and the garbage needs to be taken out from the thing in the house to the cans, I take it and I put another bag in and I don't bitch about it. Because that was my choice. But we determined who did what. What were your preferences? And then we had a list of nobody wants to do those. We wrote them down, put them in a little thing, and we grew. And we do them for like 2 months at a time, the things that we don't like to do. And that alternates, so it's not a big deal for anybody. There's always solutions. You know, we had a thing that we had a big problem about for a long time. It was toothpaste. He doesn't use toothpaste like I like it used. He squeezes it in the middle of the tube, and I'm an end squeezer. Now, that's not a big deal, but you'd be surprised how many mornings we got started off wrong because we had gotten into an argument about how we squeeze the toothpaste. And my father said, why don't you buy 2 tubes? And I said, but he'll still squeeze his in the middle. She said, yes, and he'll be happy with it. And she said, and you leave it alone. And so, you know, that was the thing. See, I was trying to force other people to conform to do it my way. Because it was so much more neater if you did it from the end, you know. It's no big deal. We don't argue about those little things like that today. Those little things kept us honed to a pitch so that when something middle-sized happened, you went berserk. You know. Worked up to it. So we've learned to be flexible. And I don't do for him what he needs to do for himself. In other words, those duties that he has assumed, if it's something that's not bothering me, but I just see he's not doing it, if I focus in on that, that'll begin to bother me. So I try not to pay attention to it. And just let it go. And you know, sometimes things need to have been done. You know, my big thing was, well, if I don't do it, who will? And my sponsor had the best answer. I don't know, we'll see. And you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised at how things get done. There's another thing I found that was defeating for him or me, either one. When it's somebody's duty to do. Now, and I've got several people that have large families, and they work this out, and everybody in the family has chores to do. Because it gives them a feeling of, if you have responsibility, it gives you a feeling of satisfaction. Even down to a 3-year-old. The 3-year-old's responsibility is to take his blanket and his dirty clothes out of his little hamper and to the washroom. That's his responsibility each week. And he loves it. In fact, he goes around and empty other people's hamper if they're not careful. You know, because he's feeling a part of. He gets to set the dishes on the table. The older sister puts them at the places. And she said, yeah, it was so scary seeing him carry china to the table. But she said it was so good. But the bottom line is when you assign somebody a duty or they assume a duty, let them do it. Don't go behind them and fix it. You see, that is when our perfectionist nature, we have a tendency to want them to do it. Do you ever have your kid and tell them to clean up their room and then you go in and inspect it and redo it? That defeats them. Because it gives them, I know how that felt when I was a kid growing up. That gives you the feeling that there is nothing you're ever going to do that's going to please them, so you just don't give a damn. And you don't even try. It kills a person's initiative when you don't. You know, there's such a thing as praising them and saying, you're doing real good. And then later on, maybe a day or two later, say, honey, if you can improve here, let me show you, or whatever. But you don't go right behind somebody and redo what they've done, because that defeats them. I found that with J.D., when he was when I was out there in the yard, I was trying to help him do some of the yard work, and he'd come behind me and redo what I'd done. And it made me feel like, well, who gives a crap? You know, I just won't come out here and help you. I mean, I was wanting to be out here with you and spend some time with you and help you in the yard, and if that's how you feel about it. And that wasn't what he was saying at all, but that's how you feel when you're doing your best and somebody comes and remakes it over for you. And I thought, and what's the difference did it make if that tree was a little crooked? You know, so I didn't get it all tamped down on one side. Big deal. You know, tree still grows. And the same way was, so what if he doesn't fold his socks the way I like them? You know, I mean, I'm not the one that puts on his socks. Why should I care? We were married for about 9 or 10 years when he told me he hated the way I folded his underwear. Now, I've been folding underwear to suit him. Now, can you imagine one of us not saying something in 9 years about something that bugged us on a daily basis? My husband's amazing. I looked at him and I said, when did it start bothering you? He said, from the very beginning. I have awareness of my limitations and also those of my partner. And I try to practice acceptance in both areas. I know my husband is a welder. He is not a mechanic. I don't expect him to fix the car. I used to. I did. I would feel like anything I couldn't do, he ought to be able to do. And he couldn't. And then he would go out there and try because I expected him to. And then he'd mess it up. And then it would cost us twice as much, and then I would be mad about that. And so I learned that if I would not expect him to do and put expectations on him, and he was able to communicate back and say, I can't do it. You know, it's real hard for us to say we can't do something. Well, it's hard for them, too. But now I know when certain things go wrong. I know what his limitations are, and I just call the plumber, or I call the mechanic, or what have you, and I don't hassle him about it, because there's no point. And he doesn't ask me to sew for him. Thank God. You know, my mother was a dressmaker, but I don't even sew buttons on. And he would hand me stuff and say, this needs to be fixed, and I'd just look at it. And I think, now, you know, I need to know how to do this. I should know how to do this. I was around it all my life, but I don't know how to do this. And it was hard for me to tell him, so I just wouldn't do it. I'd go buy him a new shirt instead of sewing on a button. It was easier. And see, God took care of that. When I prayed about that, he sent me a grandbaby who sews. I'm aware of his abilities, and I try to praise him when he does good and when he uses those. And I praise myself when I do well. I don't know about y'all, but do you ever feel like sometimes that when you've cleaned your house or done whatever, and it's just a normal routine task, but you've done a real good job, and you'd like somebody to say it looks nice? Well, you're somebody. I'll say, Miss O, you did a good job. And then I'm not dependent on somebody else for my good feelings. I've already taken care of it myself. How about peace at any price? Does anybody have that little number? Peace at any price. Well, let me tell you, peace at any price is just too darn expensive. Because when it eats my gut, it costs too much. And I have a right to say how I feel about everything or anything. I don't have a right to expect them to change, but I have a right to let somebody know. You know, there's just like J.D. with the underwear, how I was trying to do that as a convenience for him. And instead, I was doing it not the way he wanted it. And so it didn't hurt me to change and do it the way he asked. It just doesn't hurt. Let's take a short break here, and we'll reconvene at 2:30. It's now 2:20. Give us a little time to go out here at the little room.